Hi, I'm Tom, and I'm a Gen X grown-up, and I support Gen X grown-up on Patreon. And you should, too. Go to patreon.com/GenXGrownUp.
No life, no fun. Don't you know that you're a grown-up?
Gen X grown-up is a YouTube channel, website, and audio podcast you're listening to right now. All made for and by people who love exploring media, games, tech, and toys of yesterday and today through the eyes of Gen Xers who refuse to grow up.
Your dinner cannot just be french fries.
Welcome back, Gen X Grown Up Podcast listener, to this backtrack edition of the Gen X Grown Up Podcast. I am John. Joining me, as always, is George.
Hey, how's it going, guys?
You know that Mo is here with me.
Hey, everybody.
Back in 1986, we all took flight with Lieutenant Pete Maverick Mitchell as he and his Rio Goose strove to prove themselves as the very best U.S. Navy combat pilots. And now, on the eve of a cinematic sequel 36 years in the making, we remember this Tom Cruise classic Gen X era film, Top Gun. Whew, that is a mouthful, but this is a mouthful of a film. Man, so we just said Maverick is coming out. We talked last episode that this new film is on its way. It's been in the can for a couple of years. COVID delayed it. Mm-hmm. We had back then, hey, when it's time for Maverick, let's talk about Top Gun. We kept moving it. Well, luckily, as you listen to this, if you're listening on release day, Maverick comes out tomorrow. So you in the future can go see it in just a day. We still have a couple weeks to wait. Before we get into talking about Top Gun, and man, there's a lot of cool stuff to talk about. And remember, let's take just a second here to read some fourth listener email. You know, all three of us are going to listen. If anybody else does, that's the fourth listener. And the fourth listener this time around is Bart A. Bart A actually dropped us a line over on our website where you can read articles and listen to the podcast, and you can just leave a comment right there if you want. And that's what Bart did. He said, "Hey guys, love the 80s detective TV shows episode." All right. Mm-hmm. "My favorite show was Magnum P.I. and Magnum is currently streaming for free on the Roku channel, along with some other 1980s TV detective shows that you discussed."
Yeah. Okay. Good to know.
Okay.
Roku does a good job of that kind of thing.
Yeah. It's almost like you don't need those little My TVs and CW things anymore. Now they have their own original content and all that stuff is going to things like Roku. So good on them, of course. Yep. Bart goes on to say, "One thing I wanted to remind you of was that the 80s did crossovers with TV stars of one show showing up on other TV shows." He mentions that Simon and Simon crossed over to Magnum P.I.
Oh, really?
Oh, wow.
I didn't know that.
Yeah. In October of 82.
Wow.
Murder, She Wrote crossed over to Magnum P.I. in November of 86.
Really?
I had to go and see a clip of this. Yeah, like they all show up there.
She had a knitting convention in Hawaii or something? What happened?
I didn't watch the whole episode, but I went and saw a clip of it, and sure as hell, there she is on Magnum P.I.
Wow. Same character.
Yeah, sure enough. She's Jessica Fletcher, like she was. And she's there doing something with... In Hawaii. Right. She's probably at a writing convention, and somebody gets murdered, I expect. That's the normal...
Of course, because wherever she goes, someone gets murdered, right?
I know, yeah. But yeah, there's a lot of crossovers like that, and linked up stuff. Like there's a bunch of stuff on Fresh Prince, right? Then, like, the Jefferson show up in the finale of that to buy their house and it's a thing. I promise. I looked it up. It's true. But yeah, crossovers. Before there were cinematic universes, there were TV universes. Well, Mork and Mindy came out of Happy Days, right?
Yep.
And so did Laverne and Shirley.
Yeah,
that kind of stuff.
Johnny Lestrachi.
Yeah. So he wanted to point out, hey, love the episode, and he wanted to talk about the fact that a lot of crossovers happened.
Cool.
He wraps it up by saying, "Keep up the great work. Love to listen to your podcast while I drive to work."
Oh, thanks. Awesome.
Nice. Bart A.
Yeah, thank you.
That's a great way to kill time. Just listen to us make fools of ourselves and entertain. we love it. Hey, Bart, thanks for writing in on the website. If you would like your email or comment or whatever feature here on the show, you can do what Bart did. Drop us a line there or hit us up at podcast@genxgrownup.com. We read every single one, and most of them, like Bart's, eventually make this show. All right. I am ready to talk about some Top Gun. We're going to get right into that. We get back from this break.
Pit Pass Moto, sponsored by Moto America, is the show that keeps you up to speed on the latest in motorcycling and brings the biggest names in motorcycle racing right to you. From candid interviews with the top names in racing to providing insights into the trends and trendsetters driving the motorcycle industry, we have you covered. New episodes are available every Thursday at pitpassmoto.com and on your favorite podcast app. Ride on!
Be sure to subscribe to or follow Gen X Grown Up wherever you listen. And while you're there, rate and review the show, too. It helps more than you know.
I'm going to send you up against the best.
Yes, sir.
You two characters are going to Top Gun.
I feel the need. The need for speed.
5 weeks, you're going to fly against the best fighter pilots in the world.
You guys really are cowboys.
I'm an instructor at this school. I see 20 new hot shots every 8 weeks.
I don't like you because you're unsafe.
That's right.
I am dangerous.
The wild card. Buzz by the seat of his pants.
Yeah, I guess when I see something, I go right after it.
It takes a lot more than just fancy flying.
You know what we're talking about. It's all about the 86 film Top Gun in this backtrack. I just rewatched it and found it still a great film. Been avoiding spoilers for Maverick, which is kind of what prompted us to do this episode. But the little bit I've heard said it's actually really, really good. So I don't want to jinx it. But we'll get to Maverick later. Right now, it's all about the 86 film Top Gun. And as we typically do when we talk about a film like this or the history of anything, we like to start at the beginning, the origin, and how the film got made or how it came into being. And Georgia, you did a bunch of research to try to get us prepared for this. You want to get us started?
Yeah, sure. I mean, Top Gun is kind of an unusual show for the era, or at least so I thought, until I started doing all the research that I wanted to do, because there's some interesting facts about this movie. So first of all, the primary inspiration for the movie actually came from an article by a guy named Yude Yone, I think. I don't know how to pronounce it, but anyway, it was from the 1983 May issue of California Magazine, which Jerry Bruckheimer apparently read.
Okay.
And it talked a lot about the aerial photography by one of the people who actually ended up working on the movie, Charles Heater Heatley, and him being at the Top Gun Academy. So that's what gave Bruckheimer the idea that he wanted to make this movie.
Okay. Oh, I didn't know that.
He read in a magazine that talked about these Top Gun pilots and was like, hey, I think there's something here.
I could make a movie about this.
I just imagine that he was probably on a flight from one place to another reading them in flight magazine, maybe, or something like that.
It does sound like it, doesn't it?
There's a couple of other things that are neat. So first of all, everybody probably knows the story who has watched the film, but the Navy gave, at that time, unprecedented access to its vehicles, its naval fleet, the aircraft pilots themselves, in order to make this movie. So they got the director and some cameras out on John, the USS Enterprise.
Right. Naval carrier. Right.
Yeah.
Awesome.
Yep. And they filmed a whole bunch of that stuff that we're going to talk about a little bit later on, especially some of the intro sequences of the movie and some of the dogfighting sequences that happen later on.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the aircraft that they used were the F-14 Fighter Squadron VF-51, the Screaming Eagles, which Tom Skerritt talks about in that scene where he and Pete Mitchell are at his home and they're talking about what happened with the
fire. Okay. I remember that scene.
Yeah. So that's where the aircraft came from. And of course, the USS Enterprise was the naval carrier. Here's the interesting monetary fact that to this day still blows my mind. Paramount, the people who produced the film, paid as much as $7,800 per hour for fuel and other operating costs whenever the aircraft were flown outside of their normal duties.
Is that like 1985 dollars, $7,800 bucks?
That's 1985 dollars. Today, that's around $19,000 per hour.
Whoo, man.
Even with that, were they getting was that a discount though, I wonder?
So there's some stuff coming up that definitely they got some discounts, but that is when the planes were flown outside of their normal operations, right? Okay. And there's the famous story that everybody talks about how he wanted the ship turned a certain direction so they could film the aircraft with the sunset behind them.
Oh, geez.
Wait, I didn't know this story. Really?
Yeah. Yeah.
They did it?
So did they do it?
They did do it, and
oh,
they got
God.
Charged $7,800 per hour.
Oh, my
It's going to take a minimum of 4 hours to turn it, Jerry.
I know.
Sorry.
It takes forever to turn one of those things.
Because I need to buy a Ferrari.
That wasn't even Jerry Bruckheimer. That's Tony Scott, the director. That's how much power that guy had on that movie.
Wow.
He said, I need to film these aircraft landing on the aircraft carrier at sunset.
Oh,
$7,800, sir. Okay, let me write my check. Oh, yes, sir. Somebody turn the ship.
Yeah. Hard to starboard. You know, so you're already kind of getting into one of the things that makes this film so real and tangible, and it feels so visceral, because it wasn't a bunch of CGI. It wasn't a bunch of editing tricks. they had unprecedented access to real like equipment and gear, and you said ships and planes, and so what you see is not like, oh, that's fake. It's not fake. And P.S. it's really real. It's super real. It's like real planes, real pilots, real fuel being burned. That's why it stands up so well. Part of it anyway, I think.
For me, it does. I mean, you've seen other war films out of Hollywood before.
Stock footage.
Right. Yeah. You know, they had some nose cam footage that they got from some plane in World War II or something that they edited into the film. And it doesn't feel like it's a part of the movie.
I know. I've seen the same plane crash like five times in different movies.
It's like in 10 different movies,
That one scream that happens in every Hollywood movie when somebody dies or something. Top Gun had that going for it, but it also had something else going for it. And this was something that I ended up going down a long, 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 long rabbit hole that I didn't expect to. So this is a government co-opted film, essentially.
Yeah.
The government subsidized part of the film, and they got certain rights because of that subsidizing. Like, they got first script approval and stuff because they wanted to make sure it didn't show the Navy in a bad light and different things like that, which nowadays we can imagine. But back then, nobody really thought about that. At least I didn't. I was younger. Yeah. I didn't think, oh, they had to get the government to say it was okay for Tom Cruise to flip the MiG pilot off or something like that, right? It turns out, though, that is not uncommon at all. Apparently, the FBI alone, along with the Department of Defense, have financed or partially financed over 800 films.
Holy shit.
Really?
That's one freaking rabbit hole you went down.
I went down. The CIA wouldn't even allow themselves to be in a film until an Alfred Hitchcock scene showed the CIA plaque in the background of a scene.
Really?
Wow.
And after that, they got script approval on anything that was CIA related.
I did not know that.
It's like government propaganda baked into the cost of making the film.
That's exactly what I'm saying. And that's what this film embodies, that to its core, because this whole film, as we'll find out a little bit later, it was essentially a propaganda piece for the Navy.
Yeah.
And there are some amazing statistics that show just how successful it was.
Yeah, it really was.
I can imagine. Who doesn't want to become a pilot after watching that film? You're like, there's so much bravado, so much excitement and heroism. And
crazy, crazy stuff.
And the thing about it being propaganda for the government, this is in 86. And nothing was perfect back then. But compared to modern times, which I'm kind of thinking about how the sequel is going to handle this, government and the military in general was quite a bit less blemished than it is today. You know, it was a little more upright, and there was less, maybe less we heard about, who knows.
Yeah.
But feeling good about the government and the military was popular back then. You know, it was
fun.
Think
about who the president was at this time. This is 1986.
So is that Reagan era?
Reagan.
Yeah. Reaganomics.
Reagan was all about military funding and all about military positivity. That was the whole thing. There's even a story, I went down in that rabbit hole, that apparently Marlon Brando wanted to do a film about the Noriega and us sending arms to the Contra scandal.
All the North Contras,
And the government propped up a fake company, quote unquote, chaired by Oliver North, to buy the rights away from Brando so Brando couldn't
do it. So it wouldn't get made?
And it never got made, exactly.
Well, you got the money. Throw it around.
Yeah, I guess.
What else is it good for?
They have our money. That's the part that pisses me off. It's all taxpayer dollars.
That's true. Hey, yeah.
Well, wait a minute. I didn't think about that.
Damn it. Yeah. That sucks.
One last little fact that I want to talk about before. Well, I'll go ahead and give you the budget and box office numbers first. So the budget for this film was $15 million.
Oh, that's
box office, $357 million.
Wow.
Woo.
It made some money.
Yeah, they made their money back.
They got their money's worth returning the boat around, didn't they?
Yeah,
holy
they
crap.
I mean, $15 million does not sound like a lot. Even for that time, it doesn't sound like a
remember,
lot.
Remember, government subsidied.
Yeah, that's true.
So that's Paramount's budget. The government funded it outside of that.
Oh.
Oof.
It's fun. It's very telling. If you look at Rotten Tomatoes, this film has a 57% rating.
That's
from
it?
Critics. Audience, 83%.
Oh, okay. Mm-hmm.
So it's a huge split because they say, oh, it's propaganda maybe, or they saw it as it's kind of melodramatic and whatever, but it was damn good and audiences ate it up. I did.
So, John, I want to talk a little bit about a specific person who was one of the pilots, not one of the actors, but one of the actual pilots on the film.
Okay.
Okay.
Yeah.
So this guy was a future NASA astronaut. His name is Scott Altman. He piloted the F-14 aircraft for almost all of the film's stunt sequences, not the ones where they turned the ship and got him in the sun, you know,
actual,
all that
actual in-air stuff,
but the actual in-air, like close-up stuff. John, right. One of your scenes that you were like, is that a composite or did they really film it? Apparently they really filmed it. He was the guy who flipped the bird to the Russian MiG.
The inverted flight thing really happened?
The inverted flight part really happened and he was the pilot.
That's way too dangerous. Oh my God. I was sure that was composited. Why would you do something that risky for a movie? They were like 2 meters apart. It was bananas.
It was crazy.
More like a meter and a half, said Goose.
Yeah. The other part was, you know, the whole storyline throughput thing where he talked about buzzing the tower and he gets in trouble all the time.
Yeah. Well,
Scott Altman, he was the guy who buzzed the tower in all those scenes.
That was Altman's thing?
Yeah.
And every time the guy had just gotten a cup of coffee, every time he spilled it himself.
I want some butts. I just love that a NASA astronaut is the guy who's buzzing the tower. Like, did he ever buzz the Mir space station when he went up with the NASA space shuttle or something?
Well, it's less dramatic. Boop.
Right.
I know.
Boop is not that exciting. Right?
Yeah.
Actually, I think if you're in the space station, it'd be very exciting.
Yeah.
Well, just being there in general. Okay.
No, just watching his space shuttle come closer. Like, is he turning? Maybe he's going
to
stop.
Who knows? Maybe for this upcoming film, they got the government to do a special shot with one of the Blue Origin spacecraft. I don't know. We'll find out.
We're going to buzz the space station in the sequel? I don't know. That might be a bit of a reach. Top Gun Moonraker or something.
Top Gun out ISS. There you go.
Yeah, ISS. There you go.
I'm Ken Harbaugh, host of Warriors in Their Own Words, a podcast that presents the unvarnished, unsanitized truth of what we have asked of those who defend this nation. As a country, we need these stories more than ever. Stories from Americans who have borne the battle, including 30-year-old remastered interviews with veterans from World War I recounting their time in the trenches of Europe, and with veterans from World War II, Korea, Vietnam, and from our most recent conflicts in Iraq, Afghanistan, and other battlefields Americans may never have heard of. Hear their stories by listening to Warriors in Their Own Words wherever you find podcasts.
You're listening to Gen X Grown Up. But if you have a friend who's not yet listening, why not? Tell them about us. They'll thank you later.
In case some of you wonder who the best is, they're up here on this plaque on the wall. The best driver in his reel from each class has his name on it. And they have the option to come back here to be Top Gun instructors. You think your name's going to be on that plaque?
Yes, sir.
That's pretty arrogant, considering the company you're in.
Yes, sir.
I like that in the pilot.
One of the things that made Top Gun great was the cast and the crew. I mean, whoever did the casting for this movie, they spot on, I think, picked every single person, I think, in
there's
this.
A lot of 80s talent in this, just that we saw later before then.
It's like a who's who.
Yeah, they all came together. You mentioned, George, maybe we should start with the behind-the-scenes guys. So you talked about the director who made him turn the boat, Tony Scott, right?
Yeah, and unfortunately, now this is Ridley Scott's brother of Blade Runner fame, which we were talking about last week. Tony Scott, unfortunately, committed suicide in 2012. So that's kind of been a big, sad point. This was one of his biggest films.
Oh, yeah.
He and his brother, obviously, very talented directors. They've done a lot of great work in cinema, Aliens, and so on and so forth. But yeah, Tony Scott, he was the perfect director for this film. I mean, I don't know who else ego-wise could compete with Jerry Bruckheimer, the producer, but he definitely could.
And I think this was pretty early in Bruckheimer's career, too. Like, before he was known for, like, the big bombastic blockbuster kind of thing, right? It was relatively
new for him.
Yeah,
this is before films like The Rock and his Transformer movies and all that kind of stuff. I mean, yeah, Bruckheimer, he's become known for a specific film look, I would say. Mm-hmm. And Top Gun is absolutely one of the first to hit that mark.
And there's a parade of people that you could call genuine movie stars in this film. But one of them that you just cannot deny what you think about him personally or what kind of craziness he puts out. But the title star who plays Maverick, Tom Cruise, what charisma he brought to this role.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think you have us talking about this film if he's not in that role. And I'm not a big fan of Tom Cruise.
If he's not the guy.
Yeah. I think he definitely plays that same kind of character in this film that we see him play in several films right around there. There's this
he's
film.
Cocky, self-confident.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yep. There's a Color of Money that he plays a very similar character to, the cocky, arrogant, you know, who has to push through all of that to get to the good part of him later.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. But it works here. You know, it totally works here.
Well, it certainly does. Yeah. I mean, you walk through that. The fact is he's cocky and self-assured, and that plays well here because it's justified. He is arguably the best pilot to come through the Top Gun Academy in God mm-hmm. knows how long. And he knows it. He's sure coming in. He says, I'm going to win the Top Gun. And like the instructor goes, I like that you say that. That's good. Everybody should think that already going in. Yeah. Now, the huge career that he had, you take the female lead that played opposite him, who has done next to nothing since this film, Kelly McGillis.
Yeah. She had Witness.
Yeah, Witness. I remember her.
Was she in that? Okay.
Yeah.
And this one. And apparently she did a lot of TV, I think, you know, TV movies, that kind of stuff.
Oh, okay.
But still, though, but nothing to this level.
And this was during a time when if you went from film to TV, that was like a death knell.
That's right. Oh, you're not in movies anymore. You're just an actor, right?
You're not good enough to be on the big screen. You only got talent for the small screen.
Yeah.
Interestingly enough, her character is based on a real person. It's the only one in the film that is.
Oh, really?
Is that right?
Yeah, it's based on a woman named Christine Fox, who is just as tall as McGillis. Apparently, they're just an inch off of each other. They're blonde, leggy, the whole nine yards. And her call sign, the real person's call sign, is Legs.
So was she in the Navy? Was she a pilot?
No, she was an instructor, exactly.
But she had a call sign, just like her.
She had a slightly different background. Instead of being whatever it was that Kelly McGillis' character was, the real character, Christine Fox, was a mathematics wizard. So that's why she was there. Mm-hmm. They talk about some of the stuff in some of the articles that I wrote, that originally the character was just supposed to be a dumb blonde love interest. Wasn't mm-hmm. going to be the thing it was until when they were scouting at the Top Gun Academy, they met Christine Fox and they said,
like,
okay,
what if it's this instructor?
This is the character.
That folds layers upon layers. And how many times did they say in this, this is going to be complicated?
Yeah.
Right? Because she is the instructor. And she has a role to play. Yeah. I was about to say maybe my favorite actor cast in a role here, but then I remembered there are three or four more, but I'll still say it. Maybe my favorite actor cast in a role so far that we've talked about is actually Val Kilmer's portrayal of Iceman. Yeah. He is so intimidating, and he's just like disarmingly charming, yet a little too handsome. And just, he's so intimidating. And even up against Tom Cruise, you can tell, is visibly like rattled by him all the time. Mm-hmm. It's so well done. I love him in this role.
I'd say he kind of stole most of the scenes he's in.
Would you?
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, even just the way he delivers some of the little one-liners, like that scene where, you know, he's talking about, oh, the trophy for second place is in the women's bathroom at that first thing. Just little lines like that that he delivers that some of the other actors play off of as well. I think he just really kind of grabs the attention in most of the scenes that he's a part of. Now, he's not in every scene because we have to have the love interest scenes.
No, when he's there.
The instructor scenes. And, but he's really, really solid.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And, you know, I heard rumors that he's not going to be a Maverick, but Val Kilmer had throat cancer and he can't speak. Actually, he can't speak anymore. They had to remove his vocal cords, I heard. But still, though, I mean, this time, I mean, this was his high point. I mean, the 80s, he was making every movie pretty much out there had Val Kilmer in it.
This was straight after Real Genius.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Which was arguably his breakout role.
Yeah. Which was a comedy. And then he was cast here. And you talked about how the military had like approval on the script. You can see in the rivalry of these characters, like they're at each other's throats, but with a subtext of respect the whole way through. It's like, I'm out to beat you, but we are brothers at the core kind of thing. And you could feel that in the way they act, the way the dialogue runs, can't you?
So interestingly enough, a lot of the people who I read interviews and had talking stuff, the military doesn't like Tom Cruise's character in this movie.
Really?
Because
what about it?
It's completely against everything they preach for their pilots. Their pilots are all about discipline and respect and all like that. Because when you act like a maverick, you get yourself and other people killed.
When you act a fool, right.
Yeah, makes sense.
So apparently Val Kilmer's character of Iceman was the real military pilot.
The straight and
that
narrow
was their favorite
kind of dude.
Yeah.
That makes sense.
One of the people in the movie, which almost seems like a miscast, but he does it so well, was Anthony Edwards.
Goose.
Yeah.
I love him in that role.
He was great, but you look at, look at these other guys. They're all like, they're men's men, right? They're all like,
he's a little softer
like
character.
The whole volleyball scene. He's the only one with a shirt on.
He's warmer, more friendly. He has a family and kids, and he's a different kind of guy.
Too.
But up against Tom Cruise,
the
and they have that brothership
amazing.
As being partners. Oh,
yeah.
And we'll talk about the part later that's hard to watch because Goose is so good. But
what? No, but just the relationship between them was just funny. Like when even like Tom Cruise is in the thing, and he's like, when I was, he's like, we. Yes, I'm sorry.
Right.
Thanks,
Mav. Thanks. Yeah. Thanks for including me.
Well, because the Rios are often like forgotten in the film, right? They're the second person in the chair. They don't really have what we as an audience feel are the main role in the plane. But that's why he's such a great comedic foil to Tom Cruise's I'm intense and my father is blah, 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 and all this bad backstory, blackness. He's the comedic foil that allows us to still enjoy the movie.
I think he makes it almost like a human. Like he brings like the level to it.
He humanizes
right?
the whole characters, including Tom Cruise's.
And you know what else he does? He humanizes the Tom Cruise character too, because Maverick is just absolutely off the rails and crazy and bananas, but Goose can rein him in. Remember after the flyby, he came and talked to him. He's like, dude, you can't screw this up for me. I can't flunk out.
Right.
And he's like, I swear to you, I won't. So he's somebody who actually has control over this wild card because he's such a warm character. And they play together really well.
Yeah, he has the loyalty. Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. And so this is the problem I had where I didn't want to say that Val Kilmer was the best cast, because then I knew coming up, we're going to talk about Tom Skerritt as the commander. I would follow this guy into hell. I mean, what a great characterization of a leader, especially a leader of these top tier men. I just bought it. He was so good in this.
Well, and you're talking about, when this is filmed in the mid 80s, right? We still have a piece of that Vietnam era stuff that we can talk about in movies, right?
Oh, sure.
And they're the old guard now. And that's what his character is. He's a former Vietnam fighter pilot, flew with Pete Mitchell's father in Vietnam.
Awesome.
So he has that connection to the kid in the storyline. He is so great at the general or the whatever carrot level military you want to call him. He's so great at that there's another movie that he's in called Draft Day with Kevin Costner. You guys, I know John's never seen it because it's a sports movie.
Nope.
But
nope,
you're right. He's not even in the film. His character dies before scene one ever happens. He's just a picture on the wall. But the way he played this character in this movie, when I watch Draft Day, I'm like, holy shit, I know exactly how he was as a football coach.
Oh,
I know exactly what he would have done with that role.
I think he pulls off that like that quiet confidence in this. He never raises his voice. Other people are yelling, screaming.
Self-assured.
He's just like,
he's confident of his authority.
Right.
You damn well better be too. Right.
Yeah. It's like when the guy's yelling about the flyby, he's like, oh, I think that's enough said about that. Yeah.
The only time he partially raises his voice is that next scene where he says, and broke a major rule of engagement. That's the only time where he does in the whole film.
Right.
And it's not even like he's yelling. It's just
emphasizing.
Nope. He's just emphasizing his point. There you go.
Well, one of my favorite actors is in this film, and he's the subordinate to Tom Skerritt in this movie, Michael Ironside. I love 1980s Michael Ironside almost more than any other actor I've ever seen. That guy is just pure black-hearted coldness in anything he does. He's just brutal. He could be the floral delivery guy, and you'd be like, he's going to murder somebody in this next scene.
Yeah, he does that one role, but he does it so well.
Oh, my God, yes.
He was in Starship Troopers, too. He has similar kind of role, but he just does it so well, and it fit in perfectly here.
Total Recall, Starship Troopers,
Total
Scanners.
Yeah,
I mean, the
one.
List goes on and on for that guy. He's just brilliant. And he was the perfect guy to play a character whose call sign is Jester. I'm like, that guy's not laughing at anything.
He's never cracked a joke in his life.
It's like an ironic call sign, right?
Exactly.
It's like, yeah, he's such a dry prick. We're going to call him Jester.
But I love the scene where he goes up to Tom Cruise and he's like, that was some of the best flying I've ever seen, right up until the point you got killed.
Right.
I love the way he delivers those lines. I can't do it justice, but he's awesome.
And another one of the minor characters, I guess, is Rick Rossovich. I mean, you guys may know him. He was in Roxanne. He was the handsome fireman guy.
Yep.
Who was he in Top Gun? Which one was he?
He was Iceman's back chair.
Yeah. He's Iceman's Rio. Oh,
he's the Rio for Iceman. Yeah. Yes. Yeah. He was, like you said, he's kind of second fiddle. Every scene you're focused on Val Kilmer, not that guy, kind of, right?
Yeah.
The difference of his Rio versus Anthony Edwards' Rio, like you talked about, John, Anthony Edwards reigns Maverick in, mm-hmm. but Rick Rozovich's Slider, he kind of boosts the ego of Val Kilmer.
He eggs
Kilmer.
Him on, doesn't
yeah.
he?
Yeah. He's like his cheerleader
yeah.
in the film.
He's a hype man.
Yeah.
Get him, Iceman. Get him.
Exactly.
Woo, get him. Right. Oh, you know, I really appreciate it. I didn't even realize it was Tim Robbins until the end of the film after he became Maverick's Rio, right?
Yeah.
But yeah, Tim Robbins played Merlin was his
he
call sign
Merlin.
In this one.
He was
Sam
the
Wells.
Rio.
That was Tim Robbins?
Yeah.
Remember at the beginning of the film when the one guy who's the top fighter pilot on the Enterprise
and he falls apart? That Rio.
He's the guy's Rio, and then he becomes Maverick's Rio when Maverick rejoins
yeah.
the ship.
Yeah, right. Mo was like, was that Tim Robbins? I know. I didn't realize it at first.
I didn't know that.
Yep.
Holy cow.
It wasn't until I saw him stepping in to be, and by the way, teachable moment, I didn't know what Rio stood for until we prepared for this podcast yeah. and I saw in the notes,
Radar Intercept Officer. Yep.
Who knew? Not me. Well, I'm sure lots of people knew, but I just didn't.
I did not know that.
I didn't know that. I figure it's an acronym for something because it's the military and every damn thing in the military is an acronym. I just didn't know for what.
Yeah.
Yep. So who else? We had James Tolkien. He was Stinger.
You know him, John. Please tell me you know him.
Uh-oh.
I recognized him. What do I know him from?
Back to the Future Principal.
Principal that's right.
Skinner.
Yes, of course. The bald-headed guy.
Yes.
Yeah. Yep. Yeah, of course. You're a slacker, McFly.
Yeah. And he played that exact same role.
The same guy, just
movie.
Like your father. You're yep. screwing up, right?
He's that one role, but he does it so well that you got to put
yep.
it in.
Well, you got to figure when they wanted to cast that, like, we need a James Tolkien type character. Like, here's an idea. Just get the man.
Yeah.
And that's exactly what they got. They got that same character out of him.
Yeah, because this was the year after Back to the Future.
Oh, was it?
Yeah, 85. 86? That's right. 85, 86. Yeah. That's right. Yeah.
Oh, sure. Wow.
I'll tell you, watching the film again, as I did preparing for this, to refresh my memory, it wasn't until I saw her walk out of a door that I remembered Meg Ryan was even in this
yeah.
film.
Oh, I know. Yeah.
Goose's wife.
She's Goose's wife. Right. And she brings so much heart to that role that you need because of the tragedy that's coming, right? You need someone you care about to be in the family to make it meaningful when we lose Goose a little bit later. Spoiler yeah. alert, 36 years later, right. we lose Goose a little bit later.
Yeah, but if you haven't known by now, I mean, come on.
Yeah. She was so sweet and she was so cute and pretty. And she was kind of egging on relationship between yeah, Maverick yeah. and the Kelly McGillis character, saying, you know, he's off the market. He's totally in love with you, honey. Mm, like, yeah. no. She's playing matchmaker to make sure they both know how each other feels. She becomes such a central heart of this story that when you lose Goose, in my head, I'm thinking, oh, shit, I lost Goose. And immediately I'm like, oh, shit, what's that going to do to Meg Ryan? Like, you're thinking of how it's going to impact
her. She has less than 20 lines in this movie. And
is that right?
She commands.
Yeah.
From the moment she enters till the moment she leaves, she commands every single scene she's in. And that's because she's Meg fucking Ryan. This is the 80s. Meg Ryan. I mean, Jesus Christ.
Yep. Yep.
You know, she is who she is. Believe it or not, Adrian Pazdar was in this goddamn movie.
Adrian Pazdar. Who's that?
From, what was the TV show that was so big that all the people got their superpowers when the Nova hit? You know, the with Nova the Chinese hit. Guy who could stop time.
Oh, Heroes.
Heroes.
Adrian okay. Pazdar.
Oh, him. Yes. Yeah. He's the guy who could fly.
The guy who could fly in that.
The
politician.
Yeah. Some 20 years before that. Okay.
Yeah. I mean, he's done quite a few things since then, but he's one of the background pilots in some of the scenes. He's
I
in
see.
The parts
really?
Where they're doing the, huh. yeah, he's just barely in there, but he's listed. So I thought, hey, you know, give him a shout out. He's done some fun stuff since.
Man, when you look at all this talent that's in the film, on one hand, you're like, well, obviously it's going to be a blockbuster, but we know from history, just because you have big names doesn't make it a great film.
Mm.
Yeah.
And the fact that you had like many of these people, you said, you know, Meg Ryan and, you know, James Tolkien, these people, it's not like they brought in guys who weren't yet superstars. These are people already demanding big box office, maybe not the headliner,
yeah.
but they are solid character actors that again and again are in big stuff. So that budget, how they got away for only the, you know, what did you say, 15 million or something
million.
To get this done? They must have paid peanuts because they had so many big names in this and huge talent. That shit is a payoff. Man, what a good film.
Oh, yeah.
Hi, this is comedian and writer, and let's be honest, I do a lot of things. This is Dean Archipotis, the host of Whiskey Business, the podcast not so much about whiskey as it is one with whiskey. Yes, we drink and talk about whiskey, but we do so much more with so many interesting people. For example, we talk to comedians like Greg Warren.
You know, I don't want to brag, but let's just say I can walk into a Red Lobster and get whatever. You know, I think the pause right there is probably more important than the word.
Amazing athletes like boxing champion Buster Douglas.
When a fighter's down and he's looking for his mouthpiece instead of trying to get up.
That's when I knew it was over.
Yeah, right?
And yes, Bigfoot chasers.
Do you believe in Bigfoot? And if so, does he really eat beef jerky?
The Bigfoot thing is people have seen these, and I've seen a lot of compelling evidence about it.
It's Whiskey Business with Dean Archipotis. Join us for what we call a good conversation with a good pour. You really can't ask for much more than that, can you, people? Check us out at WhiskeyBusinessPod.com, a proud member of the Evergreen Podcast Network.
Each episode of Gen X Grown Up has show notes loaded with links where you can learn more about our topics. And there's even more to see and hear over at GenXGrownUp.com.
You never close your eyes anymore when I kiss your lips. There's no tenderness like before in your fingertips. You're trying hard not to show it, baby. But baby, believe me, I know it. You've lost that loving feeling. Oh, that loving feeling. You've lost that loving feeling. Now it's gone, gone, gone. Whoa.
I want to spend some time now talking about some kind of the plot points in the story and our impressions of the film, as we like to do. We do a backtrack about a film like this. And even though it's nearly 40 years old, I thought, in case you lived under a rock, I'll tell you just briefly what the synopsis
really?
Is. We didn't let Mo read his Star Wars synopsis.
That's exactly what I was thinking.
Hey, but this one's very brief, so not like your dissertation, Mo. So.
No, but mine was thorough and it was complete.
It was thorough and complete and not redundant.
Right.
What?
Okay. And unredundant. Totally unredundant.
Unredundant? Is that a word?
I don't know.
It is
it
now.
Is.
Yeah. In Top Gun, students at the United States Navy's elite fighter weapons school compete to be the best in class, and one daring young pilot learns a few things from a civilian instructor that are not taught in the classroom. Yeah.
Anyway,
that's a pretty good brief.
Anyway.
Not redundant. Not superfluous. No.
Pulled straight from Wikipedia.
It is not. It's from IMDb. You hush.
Okay. I forgot where I got it from.
First thing I wanted to mention, just off the top, was you remember we watched the Blues Brothers and George gave me so much shit for how long we had this establishing shot of Chicago and nothing was happening. And So I realized the opening of Top Gun, over 4 minutes of just carrier footage and guys pointing and jets taking off and landing and yawn.
You know, I'm not going to argue with you. It's an incredibly long sequence that I'm sure Paramount or whoever it was, I forgot the studio already, said, look, we paid $7,800
exactly.
per hour for this footage. You damn well are going to use it.
You're using every frame of this footage.
This was jets.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's when Danger Zone kicks in, it's important jets, but before that, right. It's just planes flying around. Yep. Well, the opening scene, you start right off the bat and there's a kind of a dogfight going on. And we talked about the inverted flying and stuff. Mm-hmm. What sets everything up is the number one guy on that carrier washes out.
Yeah. Cougar.
Yeah.
Maverick kind of saves him. And he was the number one that was going to go to Top Gun school, but
he lost his edge,
washing out.
Yeah.
Maverick gets it.
Yeah. And you have the flipping the bird sequence in that, and you have Cougar about to lose his shit and almost crashes into the deck, which I thought was, at the time, I was like, oh, that's kind of scary. But now I'm thinking back on it. John, you talked about why in the hell did they do that inverted scene? That's so dangerous. Mm-hmm. Watch the landing sequence. The landing sequence where Cougar is losing his shit and almost crashes into the deck.
And he's all wobbly?
That's some dangerous-ass flying that they're doing in those scenes.
Yeah. I wonder how many times they aborted that because it was just too wobbly because it looked scary as hell.
I mean, you know that the pilot was completely in control.
Oh, yeah.
But they made it look like he really was mm-hmm. losing his shit mm-hmm. with the cuts yep. from him sweating close up on camera to yeah. the plane wobbling, like you said, in midair. Oh my goodness.
And screaming, pull up, pull up, pull up.
Pull up, yeah. pull up. Right. That was the first time I ever heard the phrase call the ball.
Oh. Call the ball. Yeah. Yep. They used that.
Was in that
well,
movie.
They got all that terminology that people already use, right? In yeah. the military. Mm-hmm. And it brought you into it like, well, you're just observing, figure it out on your own, figure it out in context. And you're like, oh, I get it.
Yeah.
They did a pretty good job of that.
I thought it was a nice way to set up what was going to be the main part of the movie. You know, the main part of the movie, Top Gun, it has to take place at the elite fighter school, mm-hmm. right? It can't take place out on the aircraft carrier. So most of the movie has to be in Miramar, Florida, or Miramar, California.
Sorry. California, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Has to be out there. It's a nice way to show us that the stakes are real. It's a nice way to show us that these pilots have nerves of steel, but also have problems that can break them. And mm-hmm. it humanizes a lot of what you're about to see, because if you just did the stuff at Miramar, this is not as good a film. You have to have right. the bookends of USS Enterprise. Yeah. You need there to you have go. Those, I think.
Yeah. Well, it also kind of established Maverick's character a little bit. The fact that he went back for Cougar,
mm-hmm.
even though he was low on fuel and all that kind of stuff, that even though they told him to land, he wasn't going to listen. He's going to help the other guy out. You know, so it kind of helped establish his character.
Which, by the way, that would not get you promoted to Miramar. That would get you put in the brig.
Mm-hmm. Probably.
Well, there's no way his character goes to Miramar.
Maverick, you're dangerous. We heard that more than once in the film. And yeah. they're right. Yeah, he is a wild card. If he were a cop, they would demand his gun and badge on the desk right damn now.
Yeah.
But then he'd get it back.
Well, he'd get it back. Because the big case, right? You need it back.
We need it back. Kind of like Dirty Harry. Right? They kept taking away his and giving it back.
There are a lot of little beats in this film that jump out at me that help put the meat on the bone. They flesh it out a lot. Just a little dialogue. And there's one that I pointed out. We talked about the relationship between Maverick and Goose and how they work together and they complemented each other so well. And there's one that I love from Goose that when I heard it, I'm like, oh, I remember loving this before. They're in the plane and shit's going bad. And Goose says, come on, man, do some of that pilot shit. The shorthand for like, it's time for you to really step it up, do the thing that I know you can do. Mm-hmm. And he can motivate his pilot. He knows that. And it shows their relationship, how tight it is. He's not going, you should pull up or do this, whatever. He's like, dude, do some pilot shit.
Yeah.
And I love that. That's indicative of their relationship, which I liked.
Yeah. I think for me, I talked about this a little bit earlier when we were talking about the different characters and stuff. Tom Cruise, it felt like it was in the same role that he had been in for 10 years. I talked about mm-hmm. Top Gun, Color yeah. Money, Rain yeah. Man. Yep. He is the arrogant guy who is barely hanging on by his fingernails throughout 90% of the film. And then he finds a way to turn the corner with the character and everybody's saved or everybody's happy, depending upon what goes on. I think you're he right. did yeah. that really, really well, from that intense stare that he has to the yelling and those slightly loose. I mean, there's even scenes like where he's a lawyer in a movie and he's got that same kind of character study.
Right.
I think it worked well in Top Gun, better than it did in some of the other films.
Mm, yeah. Well, and you talk about this a little bit earlier too, George, that even though Val Kilmer was not the star of this show, he was a scene stealer in many yeah. cases for us.
Yeah,
absolutely. I mean, I think Val Kilmer, even though this was only his third film, as I talked about earlier. So the very first film that he ever had, John, do you remember?
Before Real Genius? I don't know. What was it?
Top Secret.
Oh, was he in that?
He's really? The main character in Top Secret.
Okay. It's been too long. I didn't recognize right? that was him. It's like when you go back and watch a Twilight Zone and go, oh, crap, that's William Shatner. Yeah. I didn't know because I didn't know who William Shatner used to be. Now if yeah. I go back, really? Huh.
For anybody who doesn't know, Top Secret is the one where it had the VHS cover with a cow in boots on the
in
cover
boots.
And
that's
him
right.
in the bathroom.
That's right.
Yep. Yep.
So yeah, it was his third film. He had Top Secret, then he had Real Genius, then he had yep. Top Gun. Yep. And for such a short career, now he had done some stage stuff with some very accomplished actors before the films, but films are different than stage acting, I'm sure, as most would agree. Mm-hmm. I think he... I hate to say it, but I kind of think he acted circles around Tom Cruise in this film. Even though this was the best of the Tom Cruise type of character that he had, I think Val Kilmer's character and his acting ability was still far above Tom Cruise.
I'm not sure about that. He didn't do a whole lot of acting. He was a presence, I felt. I'm not sure he was a great actor in this, but his presence was felt probably more for me than Tom Cruise.
Well, the reason why I say acting is compare Real Genius to Top Gun to The Doors.
Mm, that's range. Yeah, that's range.
Right? Yeah. Tom Cruise, what are you going to compare? Right? I mean, Tom Cruise to Tom Cruise.
The same guy, right?
Tom Cruise, yeah. Tom Cruise, Tom Cruise jumping on Oprah's couch. That's the whole breadth of his ability.
Yeah, but like I said, I think Tom Cruise did a, you know, I think even though it was his comfort role.
Right. Oh, not a bad job.
He pulled it off.
No, he did a great job. I don't know. I just, for some reason, Val Kilmer just leapt off the screen bigger to me.
He is taller.
Because he's taller.
John, you talked about Meg Ryan earlier and how much that character impacted the emotion of the story for you. There's one line that she has that I think I always wanted a girlfriend to say to me at some point in my life. And it never happened. Yep. Number one, because my nickname wasn't Goose. But still, she says, "Hey, Goose, you big stud. What's that, honey? Take me to bed or lose me forever." Like, God damn, I love that line. She had such heart and such spirit in character.
Yep. It's wonderful. Again, Meg Ryan put that heart in there. And I remember this is one of the first films that I remember specifically seeing in the theater more than twice. I went back and saw it again. Well, it was the first run going out to see it again, because back when you see everything, right, you're like, I've seen everything, you're like, I want to see that one again, though, not see something new. And watching it, though, this time around, as I knew what was coming, I knew that we were going to lose Goose in that eject accident, right?
Yeah.
I knew it was coming, and it hurt. And now I can see the movie leading me along, making me love the character, to make the impact heavier. Like, he's so close to Maverick. He's so close with his wife and family. He's super loyal. You know, he doesn't fool around. Like, you know, Maverick's always out with the women, and you're always coming home, you know?
Yeah.
There's nothing wrong with the guy. He's sweet. He's honest. He's helpful. He's generous. He has a great family. And when that eject scene, when they're in the water and Maverick is hugging him, that is rough. I mean, more so with the buildup now that I knew what was coming. Powerful loss in a film. I remember the impact back then. It was like, oh, shit, not him. Not Goose. Not that guy.
Well, he was the brother, the father, the husband. I mean, he's all of those great character traits.
He's all the best male role models.
Yeah. Everything that we would want to live up to, right? As we were, especially younger people at that point. At least I was 86. I'm 15 years old at that point. You're right. It was tough. I think the part that really sealed it for me in that same sequence, John, is when they punch the canopy the first time and his seat shoots up and you see his head hit the canopy you know his neck is snapped right away. And then they have the two of them going down to the water on the parachutes and his head is sagging and he's limp.
Yeah. He's a rag doll. Oh, yeah. I know. Oh, and the lifting in the helicopter, same thing. He's just a rag doll. You got to let him go, sir. You got to let him go, sir. Mm. Like, no, I don't want to let him go. Powerful stuff. Yeah. Oh, man.
I thought it was more like, for me, after watching it the second time, Tom Cruise's character, it almost seemed like it wasn't sadness. It was almost like he lost a part of himself.
Oh, yeah. I agree.
Oh, yeah. He went off the rails.
As opposed to being like, I'm sad that he's gone. It's more like he lost an arm it's like he didn't know how to adjust and how to deal with it.
Well, and especially because we know after that, he leaves Top Gun Academy. He just quits, right? Yeah. He's done. And I didn't think about this as much then, but I do now in the stage of life that I'm in. You have to realize he was doing all of that piloting stuff and going to Top Gun and being all crazy because of the legacy of his father and how important that was to him. And for him to let go of that legacy and that drive because Goose died, that just shows even more how impactful that character was for him.
Yeah. Although there's one part, maybe you guys could explain to me that after watching the second time, I still didn't quite get it. But they said like, oh, is it because of your father that you're always second best?
Yeah.
And I was trying to get my head around that one and I still don't quite get it.
Well, I always read that as you're always chasing the legacy of your father. Even if you are first in your mind, you're not as good as him. That's how I always read that. How did you read that, George?
There's two takes on it. First of all, from exterior, everybody sees him as second best because his father was a fuck up. The last thing his father was known for was dying in a way that was not
questionable, I guess, right?
Heroic to the naval service. As far as everybody knew, except for Tom Skerritt. Tom Skerritt knows, he knew what really happened.
But it's classified. He can't say.
So his family name already had a black mark. So everybody sees him as second best from the beginning. He never has a chance to be better than that. Number two, I think what John was alluding to a little bit, he was second best, not just because he didn't see it in his own mind, but because he was pursuing it in a certain way to prove his father was the best.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
He was never living up to his own potential, which we hope as parents that our children do better than we do. He would never had a chance to do better than his father did because he was pursuing to push his father first.
Okay.
That's my interpretation.
I get that. Because the one thing I noticed that he was the second best on the carrier because Cougar died.
And he was always second best in the points.
And he was also second best at Top Gun, right?
He lost to Ice. Yeah.
So, it's interesting. Okay.
Yeah. One more little Meg Ryan nugget that I loved is after we lost Goose, when she could have been angry at Maverick, when she could have walked in and pounded on his chest and said, I hate you. What did she say? Goose loved flying with you. He would have done it without you, but he would have hated it. She did what she could to make him feel better when she's the one who lost a husband. And it just that she was such a core to that. It's just one more nugget that it bore mentioning. Such a touching scene.
It's tough for that character in that short amount of time to make that statement believable.
Yeah, I know.
And I think Meg Ryan may be the only actress of the time.
As close as you could get. as you could get to making it believable. Yeah. Because I would have expected her to walk in and be furious, right?
Yeah.
But
she was trying to comfort him.
And that would have felt natural.
Natural. Yeah, for sure.
I think for me, all those scenes are super important and very touching. But for some reason, I don't know why, even still rewatching this film today, my favorite scenes are the dogfight scenes against the Russians at the end of the film. Because
the climax, that last the climax, the last big scene, not the flipping
the bird part. Those are fun. Don't get me wrong. But at the end, when it's Val Kilmer and Maverick, you know, and they're the only two in there because the thing gets jammed and they can't get the other planes out. Yeah.
And there's a third one in the air, but he gets he has to bail.
So I think those scenes are my favorite because that's the time when Tom Cruise gets to turn his corner. That's the time when he gets to apply everything he learned at the academy. I'm not leaving my wingman, you know.
Right.
I think that those scenes were so beautifully shot. I don't care about the close-ups on the guys with the masks where you can't see their face being emotive or anything like that and the voiceovers that they likely did during those scenes. I don't give a shit about any of that part. The aerial photography of those combat scenes, when especially there's this one scene that they repeat twice where the planes do this little flip over semicircle, like three of them in a row chasing each other. Oh my God, that stuff is gorgeous. Holy hell, how beautiful was those scenes in 1986.
And I can't imagine you would have gotten near the impact if you simulated that with a model or with
watch
those flights and you can feel the weight. You can see the weight of these. First of all, planes flying is batshit crazy. It shouldn't work. You know, the physics behind it is amazing. And then you see them and you're like, these things weigh tons. And the flat spin that caused the problem early on, right? That kind of thing. You're like, that's just a rock dropping from the sky. The fact that you can then do the acrobatics in the air, it's damn impressive. You can see where that money went that they paid to the Navy to do this stuff because wow, did it all end up on the screen.
Well, and not just the acrobatics, but I want to give a big shout out to the chase plane, the plane that was doing the filming.
Oh, yeah.
Having to be in the perfect spot, right? To get those shots, fucking beautiful flying precision to a point. Like,
it wasn't a drone. We didn't have those. It was another guy in another plane. Yeah.
I mean, just gorgeous stuff. It's what makes that movie the movie and why the only way you could do another aerial combat movie after that in that type of frame is to do a sequel 36 years later.
You need to do more of that. Yep.
I'm Bruce Martin, host of Pit Pass Indy. Each week, I go behind the scenes of the NTT IndyCar Series and introduce our listeners to the biggest stars of IndyCar, which features the Indianapolis 500 as its cornerstone event. The men and women that compete in IndyCar may be the bravest athletes in all of sport, as danger lurks around every corner. They are able to look danger in the eye without flinching. That is why the NTT IndyCar Series features the best racing on the planet. Join me every week as we talk to the stars of IndyCar, including the legends of the Indianapolis 500, on Pit Pass Indy from Evergreen Podcast.
If you're a diehard Gen X grown-up, you can pledge your support by clicking join on YouTube or by becoming a patron at genxgrownup.com/patreon.
You are still dangerous. You can be my wingman anytime.
Bullshit. You can be mine.
we've highlighted so many of the reasons that Top Gun is such a seminal Gen X era film. I mean, from the money spent to work with the Navy, to the casting, to the talent, you know, in front of the screen, behind the scene, the story, the plot points, it was like lightning in a bottle, all these great elements together. And as we often do, we talk about films like this. It's fun to talk about the fallout, the impact, what has happened in the interim between when that film came out and how it's impacted pop culture and other cool stuff. And I've talked several times about the soundtrack. And it was on our top soundtracks podcast. Yeah. We did, right?
Yep.
It's got the Kenny Loggins in it. It's got two Kenny Loggins songs in it. It's great. And it was one of the most popular soundtracks to date, reaching a 9 times platinum and number one on the Billboard Hot 200 albums for five non-consecutive, but 5 weeks in the fall of 86. And wow. Because, as I told you, it's a damn great soundtrack. It deserves to be there. George turned me on to this little nugget that I didn't realize. The band Toto was originally going to record Danger Zone.
Oh, that would be horrible.
I like Toto, but that's not Kenny Loggins. It was just so
good.
That
would have been a disaster.
Yeah, there was some kind of dispute between Toto's lawyers and the film. Good. I hope the dispute was, you're not Kenny Loggins, and that was the problem. Because ultimately, we did get the right talent. Brian Adams was rumored as a potential
to do it, too. That could have worked, possibly. That might have worked.
Better than Toto. I'll give you that.
Better than Toto. But absolutely. Everything's
better
than Toto.
He's still not Kenny Loggins, though.
Yeah, true.
So. But think about why he didn't do it. He said, no, sorry, this film glorifies war. I'm not with that. Fuck off.
was that his thing?
That was what Brian Adams. That's why he refused to sing that song and be
good.
Part of the movie.
I'm glad he wasn't part of the movie.
Well, apparently, Kenny Loggins doesn't have that moral issue. So
he's not Brian Adams. He's Canadian. So,
Sorry. I can't do it. Well, and you alluded earlier in the show, George, that all of his success in working with the military, this actually turned out to be an amazing serendipitous recruitment tool.
Yeah.
For the military, right?
Yeah. So John Davis, one of the producers, said that it was supposed to be the Navy wanted people to go see it and say, wow, I want to be a pilot. They put up recruitment booths in some of the theaters.
Wow.
Swear to God.
Damn. To me, it's just smart.
To try and get enthusiastic people to join the Navy.
Whatever works.
Oddly enough, after the film's release, the U.S. Navy has said that the number of young men joining who wanted to be naval aviators went up by 500%.
I believe
Damn.
That. I believe it.
Ooh. Well, shit. I just watched it. I'm 52 years old, and I kind of wanted to be a naval aviator after watching it. I'm like, maybe? Yeah, maybe. I get it.
It's one of the films that made me want to be a pilot, and I still want to take pilot lessons.
Yeah, geez. No kidding.
Here's a little interesting little nugget. Remember that not-so-amazing movie Planes that Disney came out with?
Oh, the Cars thing, right?
Oh, based on the Cars,
after
right?
After Cars, okay. They did one called Planes. One thing they did with that I thought was kind of cute is that they actually had Val Kilmer and Anthony Edwards as two voice actors on it. So
did they really?
Yeah.
I didn't know that. Good for them.
Yeah. Good on them, right?
They should.
Yeah.
Why
I mean,
not?
You want to go into the deep, dark crevices of internet factoids. Believe it or not, bomber jacket sales increased and Ray-Ban aviator sunglasses jumped 40% because of the characters using them in the film. So Ray-Bans went ballistic. I mean, Tom Cruise with his shades. I mean, Risky Business and Top Gun. Every time he wears sunglasses, apparently they sell off
the
shelf.
He's a sunglass selling some bitch.
I guess so.
Somebody at Ray-Ban's like, what do you mean you gave him the sunglasses for free? Are you an idiot? And all of a sudden,
oh, and then Goose's aviators that he's packing up in the box. Oh, poor Goose. Yeah. Oh, man. the Top Gun is kind of a target of parody in many cases. Remember, what was it called? Hot Shots in 91?
Oh, this was with Tiger Blood Dude.
Charlie Sheen.
Charlie Sheen. Yeah. I was about to say Estevez, one of those guys. Estevez, Sheen, one of those
Somebody
guys.
In that family of crazy people.
It was kind of a Top Gun-y spoof and a bunch of other things being spoofed in it, too. But the one that I love a lot is, because of my love for puppets, the bravado in Top Gun was really targeted in many ways for Team America World Police. The South Park guys basically a marionette action film that was all about a squad. Now, they weren't naval aviators. They were a secret organization. But it's that same kind of top tier squad of guys. And they use that Jerry Bruckheimer over the top lens flare-y kind of stuff that he would come to be known for. It's just another impact that it had long term.
Well, you know, John, you talked about wanting to be a pilot yourself after watching this film.
Uh-huh.
You could have kind of simulated it had you grown up around Ohio's Kings Island amusement park. They had a roller coaster modeled after the film. And
wow.
Just for John, they piped Danger Zone in the wait line the whole
time.
Thank
you. I would have boycotted had they not had Danger Zone. But I'm not sure I could tolerate it for an entire 2 hours line, but maybe.
They later on it got changed as the movie became unpopular. They changed it to Flight Deck. Then it went over and became a new roller coaster called The Bat, I'm guessing because of some Batman film or something.
Sure.
But there was another ride called Top Gun at another park in California as well, from like 93 to 2007.
Oh, wow.
And they changed that one to Flight Deck as well. So,
yeah.
You know, as the film grows
they're
in popularity,
you know,
there's going to be another roller coaster called Top Gun or Maverick or
they're
Goose's
probably
going
to reclaim Flight Deck and retcon it to be Top Gun again. I hope Maverick comes out.
I would say before we get out of this, there is a website out there because we talked about how like realistic everything looks and how awesome, you know, it really felt like it was real. Apparently, there's a military website that listed 79 cringeworthy technical errors in Top Gun. And I'm like, who cares? I mean, who cares? I mean, I don't need reality. I need to believe it's reality. And I believed it watching this movie.
Now, those could be entertaining to read about and go, oh, I didn't notice that. Yeah. But it didn't damage the film in any way. It wasn't like it was replete with things you can't believe. It seems real to me.
They weren't MiG-28s. They were painted F-5s. I'm like, who cares? Okay. I wouldn't recognize one from the other anyway.
That's a website run by a bunch of actually guys. Right?
Well, it's a military website, so I'm guessing they actually know what the fuck they're talking about. It's probably other pilots.
Oh, I'm sure they do. I'm actually correct. Sure. Yeah, I know.
Yeah.
Well, the impetus for us doing this backtrack was around the release of Top Gun Maverick, which I mentioned the day after this podcast releases will be out in theaters. When we do something like this, we did this for Ghostbusters. I just real quickly want to know, for you, what will it need to do to be a successful sequel? What do you want to see? What are you hoping to find in Top Gun Maverick? Because I just sprung this on you guys, so I'll start. For me, it's the characters, like so many things. I don't need to see the great dog fights. I'm sure there will be great dog fights. I don't need to see the military bravado, testosterone-laden stuff. I'm sure there'll be plenty of that, too. I'm more interested in seeing what happens with the characters. I know there is at least a photo of Iceman because he did something to help, you know, Maverick get involved in it again. But seeing these characters, this, you know, some 40 years on, I just see what they've become and how they've grown. That's what I'm most looking forward to. The other stuff I'm sure will be there. What about you, Mo? What is it? What do you need to see in Maverick?
I kind of need the cool jet fighting sequences.
You do. Okay.
I'm sorry. Because it's really cool.
That's fine.
But also I heard that I think Goose's son is supposed to be in it as a character, if I'm not mistaken.
I think that's a major plot point. I think Maverick is training him. I'm not trying to spoil anything. I've not read this. I just like osmosis picked this up.
That's right. I think that's what I heard. But to me, I mean, that'd be cool. And I'm kind of looking forward to that. And I think, like you said, it just comes down to just cool characters and seeing where they kind of developed over the years.
That's going to carry on that powerful loss we just talked about of Goose, right? The impact of that. George, what about you? What are you hoping to see? What do you need out of a Maverick?
Well, I'm like Mo. I do need the dogfighting sequences, but I need specifically for them to not be CGI computer generated. I need them to be real filmed sequences like they were in the original movie. I don't know if they got that. There was a trailer shot of Tom Cruise pulling back on a stick and the plane going supersonic up through the atmosphere. That looked real. So I'm hoping that the rest of the film has that same kind of thing. I kind of need that because if you modernize it too much and you do the CGI stuff, I think that takes a little bit of the weight and the heart away from the film that I got from
feel
the
that.
Original.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And of course, you know, you need at least some character stress point. You need something for Maverick to have a problem with, and you need it to have real emotional impact and devastation to his character in order to progress the story through to its end.
Well, George don't need much. He just needs all those awesome things. I hope it's all that and more. I'm excited to see it. I'm probably going to see it when you listen to this podcast. I probably have a ticket. I'm ready to go see it. Before we wrap up this awesome backtrack that I've super enjoyed, real quick, what if we all got to be Top Gun Naval Aviators? You got to pick a call sign. So real quick, Mo, what's your call sign at Top Gun School?
So you did give me some notice on this. So I put a lot of thought into this. And so I actually came up with Halcyon.
Halcyon.
Because this means mellow.
Oh, mellow. All right, there we go. Okay, George, what about you? What's your call sign?
Lieutenant George Flabby Tabby Sumter at your service, sir.
Flabby. Me too. Will that fit on the helmet? That's a lot of stickers.
It just has one sticker. Everybody on our Discord channel knows exactly what Flabby Tabby would mean.
Oh, yeah. Oh, we know. Oh, yeah. I have one that I've already used because every time I play Wing Commander, you have to put in your call sign. I've used the same one for every military call sign video game I've ever played. My call sign is always, appropriately enough, joystick.
Oh, Jesus.
Okay. It has lewd implications. It has video game implications. It's great for a pilot. That's what I love it. So that's all right. So those are our call signs. Hey, guys, thank you so much for going through Top Gun with me. George, you did tons of research on this. I appreciate your help.
Yes, sir.
Fourth listeners, we hope you enjoyed this. We'll be back in 2 weeks with another backtrack, of course. But next week is a standard edition of our show. Until then, I am John. George, thank you so much again for being here.
Yes, sir.
Mo, you know, I appreciate you, buddy.
Always fun, man.
And fourth listener, it's you we all appreciate. Most of all, though, and we will talk to you next time. Bye-bye.
See you guys.
Take care, everybody.
No life, no fun. Don't you know that you're a grown-up?
Gen X Grown-Up is a member of the Evergreen Podcast family. Learn more at evergreenpodcasts.com.
No more washing shows till sunrise. Unacceptable for grown-ups. Your dinner cannot just be french fries. Basically, life sucks as a grown-up.
Welcome back, Gen X. I just smacked my camera, and that doesn't matter because nobody can hear that. Fuck, one more time. Five.
You know, but oddly enough, so, I didn't. Oh, sorry, go ahead.
I was going to say, she was. Don't say I was going to say, John. Okay. I'm 52 years old, and I kind of wanted to be a naval lady aviator.
But you got to say it first, John.
Right. If you can't say it, you can't be it.
Be it.
Fuck. Okay. Try that again. 3, 2.
I'm Allison Holland, host of the Kennedy Dynasty podcast. Equipped with a microphone and a long-term fascination of the Kennedy family, I am joined by an incredible cast of experts, friends, and guests to take you on a fun, relaxed, yet informative journey through history and pop culture. From book references to fashion to philanthropy to our modern expectations of the presidency itself, you'll see that there is so much more to Kennedy than just JFK or conspiracy theories. Join me for the Kennedy Dynasty podcast.